scale of the economic challenge, pledging to lead the country through an economic crisis and to rebuild trust in politics. Well, that makes one wonder whether Sunak is really aware of the scale of the economic crisis that the UK is in, from inflation to the cost of living crisis to the political infighting and radical changes in policy that have horrified investors, alarming international allies. Sunak has his hands full. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Sunak has the solutions needed to bring the UK out of this economic and political mess.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of, close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, we're going to go with our guests. Let me introduce them for this program. Limpet Opec, former member of the British Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Shebri Rizvi, political analyst, who also joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Limpet Opec, taking a look at the soap opera there in the UK with Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old former hedge fund boss. I picked these out, see what you think. Only been in politics for 7 years, and estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. And that is pointing to what many are feeling, that he may not be able to connect with Brits who are feeling inflation or who are in poverty. Obviously, a public that's strained by things that have put them into the crisis that they're in right now. Is that accurate?
We shall find out. But you've accurately raised his potential Achilles heel. Let's be honest, For a man who is worth over £700 million, a small increase to him of a couple of £1,000 in energy bills isn't going to be very important. He could almost be regarded as a hobby politician because he isn't going to suffer if the economy does. And so that's the biggest single question. Can he understand what millions of people in the UK are now suffering in terms of finances? The second one is, can he fix it? Liz Truss, in her 44 days in office, managed to trash the British economy. It was already in trouble, partly because of some idiotic energy policies. But she wrecked it. My estimate is that she has cost mortgage payers in the United Kingdom £80,000 million a year in extra interest rates. I'm one of those people. So can Rishi Sunak really wind back to the clock to a time where we have much more favourable interest rates, and that for a lot of people, paying an extra £8,000 or £10,000 a year is going to make them essentially poor? And then the third and the last point, is he clubbable? By that I mean, can he do what Boris Johnson did very well, which was appeal to individuals who wouldn't normally vote Conservative? But they did this time, and they gave Boris Johnson a big majority. Now, those are three big challenges. Of course, I'm not saying Labour Party could do any better, but they could win by default. If you get, if he doesn't do three out of three of the things I listed there, then two out of three isn't good enough. And that means he could lose the general election. That's what he's going to be judged on by his own party.
Taking a look at his economic agenda there, Shabir Rizvi, what is it? Do you know? Do we know? I mean, at this point, it may be too early to tell.
Hello, good evening. I don't think it's too late, because obviously the Sunak scenario is exactly the same as what the Conservative Party has been practicing for the last 12 years. We are told that it's going to be a difficult time. We have to take bold decisions. At the same time, he needs to fix the economy. What are these bold decisions? Does that mean that further cutting of the healthcare, further cutting of the schools sort of funding, further cutting on other social services in the United Kingdom? So if that's what he means by bold decisions, what I would say the bold decisions would be is to, cap the bonuses of the bankers in London. It would be to increase perhaps the taxation to the highest earners, the 1%. His own cabal, who is in the category of millionaires, should they be paying more? Perhaps a bold decision would be to have a windfall tax on the energy providers. A bold decision on the economy would be to, bring parity for the lower paid earners. I.e., for example, just take one instance, a nurse at the beginning, 12 years ago, when the Conservative Party came into power, is £4,000 less well off than she was 12 years ago. So bold decision would be to bring equal parity to the key workers, nurses, the policemen, the teachers, the care workers. I can go on, multiple other sort of employees who have really lost out, not just on pay increases not taking place, but due to the inflation, they're actually a lot poorer than they were even 12 years ago. So bold decisions. So as I said, the Sunak scenario doesn't sound any different than what has been practiced for the last 12 years. Yes, of course, the previous prime minister we've had, as you know, three prime ministers in 3 months, hers was really an experiment to see whether ideological, okay, fundamentalist, right-wing economic policies should be applied to the United Kingdom. And we saw what happened. Perhaps Mr. Sunak, being more clever than Truss, would actually do it more gently, but the end result would be more austerity, poor becoming poorer, and really the belt tightening would be required of the 99%, whilst the 1% really go to the bank all the way laughing.
When you have 17% of an increase in things like food, for example, Lampedopec, and of course we can talk about the inflation into other sectors, in particular, at the top of the list practically, would be the energy sector and gas bills. He's got to do something about those two. But the fact that our guest, Shabir Rizvi, talks about income, how it's fallen behind, obviously was behind. Inflation obviously put that in fifth gear in terms of it falling behind even more. There's got to be an impact soon. But that could only be done if you're generating income. Not to get too technical about this, but generating income would then come in through the form of projections in one sense. But in this atmosphere of a war and lack of energy and what we're looking at, which is a recession, which many say the UK is not in one, but it is in a recession, how can he bring in results quickly, which is the key here?
We are in a recession in any meaningful way. The average citizen, not the millionaires, but the average citizen is feeling a lot poorer. And you've mentioned the three big things here: mortgages, fuel costs, and food costs. Those three are crippling anyone who was just about managing a few months ago. And turning to your question and continuing the debate, it's very hard to see what Rishi Sunak can do quickly without either borrowing even more, and he has borrowed more than any chancellor in the history of Britain, certainly since World War II, or making the kind of cuts that my colleague has just listed. Both of those are very difficult. It's probably easier for him to borrow, but then, of course, the world has just marked down the credibility of British politics and British government because it borrowed so much, at least it was going to under Liz Truss. So what is he to do? He can hope for a miracle, it's not going to come. He can ditch the energy policies, which are based heavily on environmental policies now. Wherever you stand on whether there's a climate crisis or not, Britain can't afford to do this right now. He should ditch net zero, and he should use fracking and domestic oil production to quickly reduce fuel prices. In terms of food prices, they'll then come down a little bit just because energy is so important. Fuel is such a high percentage of most of the costs in the United Kingdom. But the big one is actually the mortgage situation. If you have a £200,000 mortgage, you're paying £8,000 a year extra every year. That dwarfs the increase in energy costs. What can he do about that? The only thing he can do is get interest rates down. Two ways to do that. One is to convince the Bank of England it can do that. And that's difficult when you've got 10% inflation. Or he could renationalize the Bank of England. That's the radical thing he could do. He could own interest rates, as occurred for decades, for pretty much a century in the UK, before a gesture of virtue signalling, the Labour Party said, no, you go off and set the interest rates independently. But as you can see from that list, it's a really difficult thing for Rishi Sunak to deliver, and probably it's going to get worse rather than get better. He's going to have a winter of discontent.
We need to understand, Shabir Rizvi, if you can, with the short amount of time that we have, as to what... and why, I should say, the UK is in the position that it is in terms of its economy, which is cited to be one of the worst of the G7 countries, not just because of the pandemic, but prior to that. And maybe even some saying as far back as the 2007-08 financial crisis when it hit, maybe the UK was not able to truly recover. And it was just dragging itself along with GDP increases that were not that noteworthy. Are we looking at that far back when it comes to the UK economy dragging its feet and not doing well? And then, of course, then you got COVID and then you got the Ukraine conflict and here we are.
Well, indeed, one has to look back over the last 12 years. And I have quite often pointed this out in our conversations on this matter, is that the financial crisis that hit the world in 2008, and of course it hit USA, the European Union, then we had what is called quantitative easing, literally government buying their own security, printing of money, all kinds of things. But then we had a Conservative Party came into power soon after in 2020, 2010. And they practiced really an ideologically based economic policy of austerity. This is what usually the IMF sort of prescribes to developing world wherever there's economic issues. They say that, you know, have austerity, sort of increase this, do less social welfare issues that impact the majority of the public. That kind of formula was applied not at the behest of the IMF, but really the government, which was ideologically based and wanting to really continue the practice of very sort of monetarist approach to the British economy. And here we have 12 years later, yes, you know, the mantra in the UK is even when the former Prime Minister Truss was leaving, she said Putin. But really, look, you know, the war in Ukraine may have some impact here. And the reality is that we are sort of burning money by supplying armaments to the Ukrainians. That will, of course, have an impact on the UK. Yes, we have sort of sanctioned Russia. Therefore, the oil and gas are not coming on the market, hence increasing the energy price. But the reality is that the Conservative Party needs to abandon its ideologically based economic policies. They really don't have much left in the fiscal armory to do. Yes, we've got the Chancellor who's going to be announcing his budget on 31st of October, an ominous day, Halloween, you know, which is the sign of sort of coming out of summer into the dark days of winter. Perhaps Britain is moving into the dark days of winter, whilst we haven't had a very bright summer either.
Well, to use your words, dark days of winter is what I think we're looking at, Lampedopoulos, if you agree, where there has been predictions made by, I think, the UK electric power grid that there may be three-hour outages in electricity. So let's take a little bit of a break, Lampedopoulos, if we can, from the economic aspects of Rishi Sunak and the challenges he faces there, and how he needs to get his party together. Based on the report that we just saw by Rob Carter, the Conservative Party's popularity is really lagging behind the Labour, and it has dropped quite dramatically. And there's, of course, talks of infighting within the party. How much of a challenge does that pose for Sunak, even though he is picking, I guess, new cabinet members, and a reshuffle is on the way from what we understand?
It's in process now. You mentioned the pending power cuts, which Rishi Sunak himself warned would happen. Well, the lights are going off on the popularity of the Conservative Party, and you could say that Liz Truss was massively instrumental in putting the Conservative Party 30 percentage points behind Labour. It's not because I think that Keir Starmer is doing a particularly good job. I think he's a rather poor opposition leader. But by default, the Conservatives are so unpopular that people go to Labour thinking, well, anyone but the Conservatives. And Boris Johnson didn't help either. What can he do is the question you asked me. What he can do is a good job of the economy. He can stop those power cuts, because if the power cuts come, everyone will remember, at least people of my age, will remember the winter of discontent, as it was called in 1978 and 1979, a line which Margaret Thatcher, a Tory opposition leader, went on to be Prime Minister, used against Labour. Well, they'll get that thrown right back in their face. Internally, he also has problems, because some people still blame Rishi Sunak for the demise of Boris Johnson's premiership. And because there wasn't an election, let's remember, Rishi Sunak was not elected prime minister. He was appointed by minister by default. That means there's that discontent in the party too. Can he pull it back? Not without some luck. He needs to be lucky that there aren't power cuts, because that will really put the lights out on popularity of the Labour, of the Tories, right up to the next election. And he needs to be lucky with party discipline, because there isn't much of that either at the moment. It remains to be seen if he has the leadership to do those things. For the sake of my own quality of life, I hope he does. But there's an awful lot of doubt. And Rishi Sunak, if he makes it to the election, well and good. If he gets deposed, there will be a general election, because the Conservative Party is almost torn apart as it is.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to get back into the economy again here, Shabir Rizvi, based on how things are going. But an important stat that I brought up before coming on, and I'm curious as to whether the general public there in the UK even, or the wider world, actually is aware of the fact that more than one in five of the UK population, which is 22%, actually live in poverty. I mean, that's quite a stat, almost a quarter. So if we're looking at that particular stat, all indications are at this point, if the UK is going on the track that it is, that that's going to increase. There needs to be something that bridges the UK finances in order to be able to increase people's livelihoods. And that, I'm talking very generally now, so that people don't have to suffer as much, whether it's, as Lambert Opik said, the big three, like mortgages or food or other things, the social services perhaps. The big question is, where is that money going to come from? He can't tax his way into generating income. That usually doesn't work, if I'm correct to say that. How do you think he should approach it?
Well, there are possibilities of what you're saying, that yes, one in five have huge difficulties, and also we have on a daily basis 5 million people going to the food banks. So there are a whole host of issues as far as economics is concerned. But the reality is that politics impinges on economics, and economics impinges on politics, if you like. There's two sides of the same coin. And if the political situation is not stable, and the Conservative Party carries on in this way, and I was only reading today before coming on to this interview, is that there are some Conservative Party members who are in the Boris brand, if you like, are already sort of jockeying to get rid of Sunak. And it is said that perhaps he might not last until Christmas. So that's perhaps another development that's taking place, and we'll see what happens. But his really big challenge, as our other guest has pointed out, is really the economic issue, and there aren't sort of any silver bullets for him, if you like. Taxing higher, would that generate enough revenue? Or the thought of growing the economy, as the former previous prime minister kept on saying that she wants to grow the economy. How will they grow the economy? Which sectors of the economy would grow? And then, of course, the whole issue of immigration. Do immigrants, new immigrants coming in, contribute to the growth of the economy? Because of the whole sort of problems and challenges and the sort of maligning of immigrants and asylum seekers in the UK, that, again, is not an avenue that is open to the UK to bring in new blood, sure, from foreign countries to grow the economy.
Okay. We only have 30 seconds, Lambert Opik. £2.5 billion so far assistance to Ukraine. UK has announced that it will match it for the year 2023. That's £12 million per day. How could the UK afford that?
It's a political necessity for Rishi Sunak. If he looks like he's not going to be sponsoring Ukraine, he'll be accused of weak leadership. The rights and the wrongs of it, in military terms and political terms, don't matter, except to save his back.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to end there. Lambert Opik, their former member of the British Parliament from London, and also from London, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Thank you to you both. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoy and the team, it's goodbye. Until the next program.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Keeping Secrets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of keeping secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that Islam emphasizes on the personality or the respect of each other. Therefore, it also talks about the keeping the secrets of each other. Now, we should know that when we talk about the secrets, which is known as asrar or sir or raz, like in different languages they use these words, this is known as something which is need to be kept secret from a group of people, maybe, or some special people or specific people should know about it, or maybe no one should know about it, and it's something which is related to someone's personal life. Therefore, these secrets can be related to the social aspect or the social life of a person, or it can be related to the personal life of the person. Therefore, it is necessary in Islam that we must keep the secrets of the people if we know about the secrets. Why? Because if we disclose the secrets, it might damage the personality of a person. It might bring a danger to his life. Or maybe sometimes he can even lose his life in the disclosure of the secrets. Therefore, for the mu'mineen, for the believers, it is necessary to keep each other's secrets if they get to know. Or maybe if someone is sharing his secrets with someone, as someone who he can trust, then obviously we should not break his trust. We should keep the trust of the person. And this is one of the characteristics of the believers, that he is trustworthy, he is truthful, he keeps the secrets of the others, and obviously he is someone who can be trusted in all times, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of keeping secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that every person has some secrets in their individual life as well as in their social life. Therefore, it is a necessity that if someone knows about that, he should keep those secrets with him and should not disclose. We know that everyone has it, and there is no one, no exception amongst the people. And there are some things which they never wanted anyone to know about it. And therefore, this is known as something which is personal or related to himself. And on the same basis, spying someone is being forbidden in Islam. We cannot spy on the others, but in the case of preventing the country from the enemies, that is the only case where it has been allowed. Otherwise, in Islam, even spying on others and looking into others' life, being after the secrets of the others, all these things are forbidden in the Islam, and Islam says not to perform such things. And therefore, we even see that even Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam has said, "Afsha'u sirri suqutun," that when someone discloses someone's secrets, then obviously it is just like falling down from a hill. So if someone discloses the secrets of the others, then Allah also never kept their secrets. We have many things which only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows about us. Therefore, if we disclose the secrets of the others, and if it results the dishonor or humiliation of the person, then Allah never keeps our respect amongst the people. Therefore, we must be careful in these situations, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OANA has now become somewhat of a center of world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA Summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets, as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much.
I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they could all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running ahead, well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber-stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is said to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear, and it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. Nowtown is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on 2 major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalalip from Kish Island.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's prime minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment.
Delegates from our coalition met with President Mattarella, and they agreed over the fact that there are many emergencies at national and international level, and quick answers are needed.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new foreign minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kyiv. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine.
We must do all we can to stop the war through negotiations and dialogue, and the new government must help Italians to pay energy bills. We are on our knees.
We are confident that the new government will do good. Its biggest challenge will be easing the impact of soaring energy bills on Italians.
Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me on camera. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes.
This woman, sobbing into her hands, tells me she has family in Ukrainian territory. They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses. Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly.
While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years.
While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep. And very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purisa, London.
In the limelight.
The recent attacks by Zionist settlers against Palestinians are an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. According to reports, these attacks have been perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, there have been more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank over the last 10 days, according to local media. The Israeli regime newspaper Haaretz recently said that most of the attacks it had documented had taken place in the northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus Governorate. Last week, dozens of settlers attacked Palestinian property and vehicles in the Hawara area. Witnesses told Middle East Eye that masked settlers threw rocks at Palestinian vehicles near the town, as well as setting vehicles and olive trees on fire. Abdullah Odeh, who owns a local amusement park in Hawara, said residents had almost been successful in repelling the settlers when a group of Israeli troops arrived. The settlers were retreating, but when they saw the soldiers, they came back in force and started to get closer, breaking everything in their path, Odeh said, adding, "The soldiers did not push them back. Instead, they started to attack us and shoot towards us." Footage from Odeh's security cameras reviewed by Middle East Eye corroborates his history. He says, "While the soldiers were pushing us back and attacking us, the settlers started to set fire to one of our vans that was parked higher up on the hill, while another group of them came and started to set fire to one of our lorries. Armed with stones, sticks, and guns, another group of settlers began throwing rocks at passing cars and smashing up shops along the town's main road. Recently, two activists were injured by Zionist settlers armed with stones and clubs while helping Palestinians harvest olives in the village of Kesan, south of Beit Lahm. Tali Katzir, an activist who was at the scene, told Haaretz, "About 20 settlers arrived and started attacking the harvest volunteers." Katzir said Hagar Gefan, a 70-year-old human rights activist, was among those injured. Katzir said she suffers from broken ribs and bruises all over her body. Knesset lawmakers Aida Tuma Silman and Ofer Kassit from Hadas Tatal condemned the attack and called for those behind it to be held responsible. "This horrific attack is a direct result of the criminal silence from Prime Minister Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz, and Public Security Minister Omer Bar-Lev in the face of settler terrorism," Tuma Suleiman said. Haaretz said that while Israeli Chief of Staff Aviv Kochavi had been quick to condemn attacks by settlers on Israeli soldiers, no such criticism had been made by the army over attacks against Palestinians. An Israeli troop from an illegal West Bank settlement near Nablus was arrested on suspicion of participating in a settler attack on an Israeli regime unit earlier in the day. Recently, a group of settlers threw rocks at passing Palestinian vehicles in Hawara before attacking Zionist regime troops dispatched to the area with pepper gas. A security source told the newspaper that contrary to claims by senior security officials that attacks on Palestinians were being carried out by an out-of-control handful of settlers, well known to the security establishment, they were in fact being perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. The source added that attacks by settlers were an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. Palestinian Wafa news agency also reported the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz revealed that More than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians have been documented in different areas of the West Bank in the last 10 days. The newspaper stated that in the last 10 days, settlers have attacked Palestinians more than 100 times, and that most of these attacks took place in northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus. It said that these settlers' violence was not addressed by the Zionist regime's army, who was quick to condemn the settlers' pepper spray attack against the troops. The newspaper denied claims by the Zionist regime army that those who carry out attacks against Palestinians are a minority, stating that this is not true because there are large numbers of settlers who take part in the attacks against Palestinians. In this regard, Wafa correspondents reported that the Zionist regime occupation army did not arrest or investigate settlers who attack on a daily basis the Palestinian citizens and their property, but rather guards the aggressor, the settler, and provides them with protection.